parents, colleagues, students and visitors, welcome to the Dean's Lecture Series, showcasing eminent international professionals and leaders in the built environment. My name is Julie Willis and I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Architecture, Building and Planning. I begin this evening's proceedings by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which this event is taking place, the land of the Wurundjeri from the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders and families both past and present. This is the first lecture in the Dean's Lecture Series for 2019, and it forms part of our BE150 initiative, which is running through 2019 in celebration of 150 years of built environment education at the University of Melbourne. The year 1869 marks a significant point in time for the inception and evolution of the Faculty of Architecture, Building and Planning. In that year, exactly 150 years ago, a student joined the university with a specific and expressed intent to practice within the built environment field. While a 150-year milestone acknowledges and celebrates built environment education, the BE150 program is much more than a simple celebration of our legacy. It allows us to explore the contribution of our faculty is making and will continue to make in shaping the future of built environment forms, disciplines and professions. A key component of this is to provide opportunities for students, staff and the broader built environment community to engage with thought leaders and innovators across design. Tonight's lecture brings a world-leading architectural historian, theorist, researcher, curator and author into our faculty's built environment community. Beatrice Colomina is Howard Crosby Butler Professor of the History of Architecture and Director of Graduate Studies in the School of Architecture at Princeton University and is also the founding director of Princeton's Interdisciplinary Program in Media and Modernity. She comes to us this year from her fellowship at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Berlin, where she is for the academic year of 2018-19. Beatrice has written extensively on questions of architecture, art, technology, sexuality and media, and her work is published in over 25 languages. Two of her books, Sexuality and Space in 1993 and Privacy and Publicity of 1995, have received the International Book Award by the American Institute of Architects. She has also curated numerous international exhibitions, most recently co-curating the third Istanbul Design Biennale in 2016 on the theme Are We Human? The Design of the Species, and exhibiting an installation at the inaugural Biennale of Architecture and Urbanism in Seoul in 2017. After completing her studies in Spain, Beatrice travelled to the New York Institute for the Humanities in the 1980s as a visiting fellow, where she encountered the works of Wolfgang Schivelbusch, Karl Schorschke and Susan Sontag, whose interdisciplinary way of thinking has had an enormous impact on her. Sontag's Illness as Metaphor, published in 1978, made a strong impression, and Beatrice started seeing modern architecture in relation to its pathologies, both real and imagined: agoraphobia, claustrophobia, tuberculosis, hygiene, germs, and fresh air. This interest spanned decades and resulted in several essays and chapters before finally being developed into X-ray Architecture, a newly published book and the focus of this evening's lecture. X-ray Architecture explores the impact of medical discourse and imaging technologies on the formation, representation and reception of 20th century architecture. The relationship between private space and public space has changed dramatically in modern architecture, with many 20th century architects like Mies van der Rohe becoming preoccupied with exposing the inside of the building to the public eye, exemplified through works such as his transparent Friedrichstrasse skyscraper of 1919. In what ways and to what extent did the dominant medical obsession of its time, tuberculosis and its primary diagnostic tool, the X-ray, shape modern architecture? It's an intriguing question, and I very much look forward to hearing Beatrice's exploration on this tonight. Will you please join me in welcoming Professor Beatrice Colomina to the stage?
Well, thank you very much to the team for the generous introduction and the generous invitation to come to your school. Happy birthday, 150. That's really very impressive. And thank you, of course, to Donald Bates, who has been so kind taking me around to see Melbourne, and to all the people that have opened their houses or have accompanied me to see the colleges around here, and all of the students that have been so wonderful sharing their work with me during these days. I'm really happy to be here with you. Now, as the Dean said, this is a book that has been with me for a very, very, very long time. In fact, I was going to read a little bit from the introduction, which basically talks about the fact that this bond between architecture and illness is really my longest preoccupation, that goes back precisely, as the Dean was saying, to the first year that I arrived in New York at the end of 1980, after having studied architecture in Barcelona, and by some impossibly good luck, I mean, you know, I think I have had incredibly good luck in my life, frankly, I landed as a visiting fellow at the New York Institute for the Humanities, and among the extraordinary people that were there, it was Susan Sontag, whose book, Illness as Metaphor, has just been published. And I started seeing modern architecture in terms of all the pathologies related to it, real or imagined. So agoraphobia, claustrophobia, nervous disorders, and above all, tuberculosis, and the obsession with hygiene, with germs, with fresh air, etc. And I thought that this would be a great topic for a dissertation, and actually wrote some 100 pages of it already in some kind of febrile state induced by my intoxication with New York. But there was no climate for such kind of interdisciplinary research in architecture at the time, not in Barcelona, where I was doing my PhD, and not at Columbia University either, where I was a visiting scholar the following year. So I ended up working on modern architecture and mass media, photography, magazines, film, and so on. As you know, this is what became privacy and publicity. But what is funny retroactively is that at that time, it turned out that the field of architecture was not prepared for that either. And talking about media in architecture in the early 80s was kind of an anathema. It was like if it was kind of an attack on the object, on the architectural object, or revealing a dirty secret, or even as if the media itself was some kind of illness, right? And so returning to the project of tuberculosis and modern architecture is for me, in a way, like the return of the repressed, except that it has always been somehow there in latent form, like a virus that surfaces every now and then in essays and conference paper, but never completely takes over. Actually, I had to calculate the number of articles that I have written on this question, and there were more than 12. By the time I sat down to do the book, I realized that half of the book has already been written without me aware that I was writing it. So this is what, in the end, I decided to do in my last sabbatical, actually in Berlin at the American Academy. I was prepared to work on something entirely different, but on my first days in the Academy in Berlin, I discovered that the area, Wannsee, had been actually an area where there were several tuberculosis sanatoriums. The air was famously more clean, cleaner than in Berlin, and people from the area will come to Wannsee for the tuberculosis cure. So I decided, or perhaps it was decided for me, I mean, I always think that my life, some many things, I'm not quite aware how they happen, that I will change my topic and take up again the question, this question that has been with me for such a long time. And of course, immediately I started myself imagining myself being in kind of a tuberculosis sanatorium there in Wannsee with all these other fellows that were there. And as you will see, this is very much part of the culture of the tuberculosis. But before, to give you a little bit more of a longer background, I will speak a little bit of what is in the first chapter, which is the longer view of this question of the relation between health and architecture. Because, in fact, it's not just a question of tuberculosis. The hypothesis of the book, the theory of the book, is that architecture and medicine have been always tightly interlinked. Just as classical theories of Greek polis, somehow the Greek city, follow the theories of the four humors, contemporary ideas of health organize design theories even today. So architectural discourse somehow weaves itself between through theories of the body and the brain, constructing the architect as a kind of doctor and the client as a patient. For example, Vitruvius, in the first century already, launched Western architectural theory by insisting that all architects should also study medicine. So if you think you don't have enough studying architecture, all the students in the room, just imagine that you now also have to study medicine. That's what Vitruvius say. And actually he devoted a great part, a large part of his first book on the of his 10 books on architecture to the question of health, giving detailed instructions on how to determine the health of a proposed site for a city by, he says, returning to the ancient method of sacrificing an animal and inspecting the liver to make sure that that is sound and firm, right? And then, therefore, you can also do a city there. And likewise, for the health of the site and for the building, he discusses the theory, the Greek theory of the four humors, and emphasizes the directions of the winds and the sign, and also talks about how much, in reverse, when one is unwell, one can be cured quickly, precisely through architecture, through design, right? And this is an aspect of Vitruvius, which we have read Vitruvius all in school, and nobody pays attention to this question of how much about health is in Vitruvius. And in talking about how the building can help the person that is unwell, he talks precisely about those exhausted by disease, including consumption, his words. Consumption is, of course, another word for tuberculosis. So, by the time you get to the Renaissance, and despite all these treatises, this is Cesare Cesarini, actually, translation of Vitruvius, the central reference is no longer the whole body, despite all these bodies that appear in these buildings. But as you will see, the health is really not determined by the theory of the four humors and a whole body, but a dissected, fragmented, and analyzed body. The Renaissance schools of design had the habit of placing themselves next to the medical schools, and in many ways they have the same problem. The medical school had the problem of how to get a body, with the church opposing the idea of dissection, etc., and bodies becoming very, very difficult to come by. And the architecture school had the same problem. How do you bring a building inside another building to study the building? So they do what the school of the medicine was doing, which is do cast of body parts. Well, the school of architecture starts doing cast of body buildings, and you have this phenomenon that goes all the way into the 20th century. This is MIT, the first school of architecture in the United States. There's still many of these casts around. But just as Renaissance schools started to have body casts, they also started to study dissection, right? And actually at the first Academy of Design, the Accademia del Disegno in Florence, founded by Giorgio Vasari in 1563, it was required that all students have to attend anatomical dissection at the local hospital nearby, the Santa Maria Nuova Hospital, as part of the training of the architectural students, and draw the body as it putrefied. Even as some students and even professors were falling ill, you still have to be there drawing for days on end this decomposed body. As doctors discovered that they could investigate the interior, this mysterious interior of the body by cutting it and dissecting it, architects also try to understand at the same time the interior of buildings precisely by slicing cuts through them. In the sketchbooks of Leonardo da Vinci, for example, you see cutaway views of architectural interiors that appear side by side with anatomical drawings. He even understood the interior of the brain and of the womb in architectural terms, as enclosures that needed to be cut through to reveal their secrets. This is another kind of clear example of medicine and architecture. But as you move quickly into the mid 19th century, you encounter people like Viollet-le-Duc, who illustrated his dictionary raisonné with these perspectival sectional cutaway drawings, showing medieval buildings as dissected. He had been actually very influenced by the lessons of anatomy of Cuvier, and he treated medieval buildings as a body to be analyzed. I mean, he directly talks about an animate being and requiring dissection to understand how buildings work. Well, as very quickly as this is again medical illustrations, architectural illustrations in Violet, we can move quickly to the 20th century, because as medical representations changed, so did architectural representation. And precisely in the 20th century, it was the widespread use of X-rays that made a new way of thinking about architecture possible. Modern buildings even started to look like medical images, with transparent glass walls revealing the inner secrets of structures. This is obvious when I say it, but of course these images have been seen by many people for many, many years without nobody noticing. Actually, that means was not only, and Le Corbusier were not, and all that generation of architects were not only, they were fascinated by X-rays, they collected X-rays. Mies has X-rays, Le Corbusier had X-rays, they published them in their books. And then you start seeing buildings that all of a sudden you have to look through, you are able to look through the skin into the inside of the building. In fact, Mies talks about his buildings as skins and bones architecture in case we have missed the point. Anyway, the architecture of the early 20th century cannot be understood without grasping its relationship with disease, and especially with tuberculosis, a disease for which the X-rays were, by chance, actually particularly well adapted as a means of diagnosis and monitoring of symptoms. Anyway, so in this case, today, because we don't have a lot of time, I'm going to focus particularly on the question of tuberculosis, because one could write an entire book, actually an entire encyclopedia, just about the impact of tuberculosis on early 20th century architecture, beginning with active collaborations between architects and doctors. We don't collaborate with doctors anymore, but this is still was still happening in the early 20th century in the design of tuberculosis sanatoriums such as Alvar Aalto and Aino Aalto's Paimio in Finland, with its dramatic terraces in the sky. The Paimio sanatorium even has some kind of uncanny resemblance in a canonical photograph such as this one to an X-ray of the chest. With his clean line bedrooms devoid of ornament that were designed to minimize surfaces where dust could accumulate, even the intersection of the floor and the wall beneath the window are curved, as you can see in this drawing, specifically to avoid the build-up of dust. The rooms were also equipped with all kind of sanitary fittings that were designed by the architects, including chairs whose back was specifically angled to facilitate breathing and expectoration, sinks designed to reduce splashing, and espitons to minimize sound. Also, door handles were carefully designed so not to catch up the sleeves of the doctor's white clothes. But the building's main equipment was this top floor terrace, where... Is this noise made my noise? This click, click, click. Eh? Bracelet. I don't have a bracelet. Ah, maybe the necklace. Oh, okay. Sorry about that. I thought this is really weird. What is this noise? Okay, let's see if that helps. Okay, so the main equipment is this top terrace, 7 stories above the forest, where patients were wheeled out for regular doses of fresh air and sun in the long lounge chairs that were specifically designed for Aino Aalto. Here you have her herself lying in the terrace in her own design chair. She, the architect herself, was a patient in the sanatorium. Eventually, the terrace had to be closed off because actually the nurses couldn't keep up with the number of patients that were desperate, and they would throw themselves every time a nurse turn around. So here you have this cure in which from early in the morning to late at night, patients will be there taking the fresh air, but at the same time it becomes kind of a form of assisted suicide because they will, when they turn around, jump into the abyss. The discovery and success of streptomycin in 1944 revealed that there was not a lot of scientific basis for the air and sun therapy. Sometimes it even precipitated the end, and not by immune clearly, literally. Tuberculosis actually made modern architecture modern. It's not that modern architects did modern sanatoriums, rather sanatoriums modernized architects. Alvar Aalto, for example, was a totally neoclassic architect until his conversion to modern architecture when he entered the competition that he didn't win for a tuberculosis sanatorium in Kinkoma in Finland, an unrealized project that in many ways anticipates Paimion. For Alvar Aalto, the sanatorium was not architecture in the service of medicine, but integral to medicine, an apparatus devised as a means of treatment. The main purpose of the building, he writes, is to function as a medical instrument. The room design is, so the building is a medical instrument, literally, that's what he's saying, right? The room design is determined by the depleted strength of the patient reclining in his bed. It's very important to understand that Aalto had been himself sick at the time of the competition for the building and claimed that having to lie in bed for an extended period of time had been crucial to his understanding of the problem. Architecture, he says, he writes, has always been conceived for the vertical person, but here you have a client that is permanently in the horizontal. The whole design of the room had to change, of the building had to change accordingly. Live fixtures could not longer stay in the ceiling, kind of irritating the eyes of the occupant lying in bed, for whom the ceiling had all of a sudden acquired an enormous importance, a new kind of facade, if you want. The view through the window to the forest outside also has to be calculated from the point of view of the bed. In the terrace, low parapets and thin rails will allow the eye of the horizontal person to travel far above the forest. The colors, of course, of the rooms were also very important to him. He talks about quiet, dark blues for the ceiling. He talks about bright canary yellows in the reception booth by the entrance and the linoleum in the lobby, in the corridors, etc., evoking sunny optimism even in cold, cloudy days. Those are his words. Psychological factors were, of course, also very carefully considered. An extended period of confinement, Aalto writes, can be extremely depressing for a bedridden patient. A tuberculosis patient, sanatorium, sorry, is to all intents and purposes a house with open windows. And the other way around, to see if the hospital had to be a kind of house, he says also that the house has to be a kind of sanatorium. And this is the turning point that I found most fascinating in Aalto. When he writes, I was able to discover that special physical and psychological reactions by patients provide very good pointers for ordinary housing. To examine how human beings react to forms and construction is useful to use for experimentation, especially sensitive people, such as patients in a sanatorium. The bodily and psychological sensitivity of the sick person, therefore, is used to recalibrate architecture. Even the specialized furniture designed for Paimio became everybody's furniture. Is this cantilever chair, the Birchwood of Paimio, was designed to open, as I say, the chest of the patients, allowing them to breathe easier, or that's what he says. Soon enough, this chair became everybody's chair. In fact, it's everybody's chair, even today. You can go and buy it for some couple of $1,000 or something like this. This is the interesting thing. He says that the sanatorium needed furniture which will be light, flexible, easy to clean, and so on. And after extensive experimentation, they came up with this idea of the flexible wood to produce furniture, he says, that will be suitable for the long and painful life in the sanatorium, right? So he established or they established. I know an Alvar Aalto, this workshop near the sanatorio where all the pieces of furniture for the hospital were produced. But very soon, Artek, 2 years after Paimio, it turned into the furniture company Artek, and all these pieces that were originally designed for the sanatorium became pieces for everybody's house. The reference point for Aalto is clearly the seriously ill. Aalto claimed that architects have to design, and this is very important today when you think about all these new interests that we have, and clearly so, and rightly so, on disability studies. The tuberculosis patient, he says, becomes the model for modern architect. The architect has to design for the person in the weakest position. So we are not talking all about these macho guys that are all kind of sporty and all of that. We have to design for the person in the weakest position. The tuberculosis patient becomes the model for modern architects. So in other words, sickness was no longer seen as an exception, but precisely as the norm, and varying degrees of sickness were seen to define the human condition. We are all kind of handicapped in one way or another. The modern subject has multiple ailments, physical and psychological, and architecture is a protective cocoon, not just against the weather and other outside threats, but in modernity, I mean, because we always think about architecture protecting us from the elements. Yeah, sure, they do. But more notably, in modernity, is against internal threats, psychological and bodily ailments. Symptomatically, Aalto compares his experiments in Paimio and their application to the everyday use and their application to everyday use to the exaggerated forms of analysis that scientists use in order to obtain more visible results. For example, he says, stained bacteria for microscope examination. I think that's really interesting, too, because he saw clearly designed as a form of medical research, with the sanatorium acting as a kind of research lab for modern architecture, a new way of testing architecture, looking at what has been hidden and exposing the invisible forces. And with that, I move into the invisible client of modern architecture. In fact, if you think about it, Sigmund Freud, the X-ray, bacteriology, and the germ theory of the disease were all emerging at the same time in the very short period of time, and they are all looking the invisible, acknowledging the invisible, whether it's the unconscious, the skeleton, or the macro element of bacteria, the bacillus of tuberculosis, for example. Architecture, and this is very interesting, the first X-ray, which is the hand of Bertha Röntgen, which apparently had a steel heart. He was so worried that his colleagues will find out that he was working on this, that he dragged his wife to the Bertha Röntgen to the lab and made the first X-ray of her hand that becomes like the old image of the X-ray. And then all of a sudden, all this aristocracy and all this, they decided to have their own portraits, and they all have the ring there. So the X-ray became like a new kind of intimate portrait of the bourgeoisie and the intelligentsia during this period. Well, in any case, during this period it's all about looking inside, architecture also turns itself as if we're inside out. The threat is no longer outside, but inside, in the invisible, the micro scale of the bacteria and the bacillus of the tuberculosis. It's this micro scale of the bacteria that becomes the base for furniture, like this one, right? I mean, we are also concerned with the accumulation of dust, right? That you have these incredible pieces of furniture, and also of our houses and of our cities. The micro, if you want, and the micro, the bacterium and the city. Cities were suddenly thought to be teeming with unseen occupants that, in a sense, became the new clients of modern architecture and urbanism. The micro is the new client. The architect doctor becomes a kind of a bacteriologist, generating design principles out of a laboratory scrutiny of microbes. architecture itself becomes bacterial. Le Corbusier had a very beautiful quote in 1921. He says, I tried to do some laboratory work isolating my microbe. This is Le Corbusier writing in very well-known books, but nobody sees that. I watched it develop. The biology of my microbe appearing in disputable clarity, certitudes acquired, diagnosis, etc., etc. And then he goes on to talk about modern architecture and planning precisely in terms of these bacteria and these microbes. Microbes were both the literal and metaphorical basis of a new architecture and urbanism. Modern architecture, paradoxically, had to represent this new invisible order with bright, transparent images seen as clean and clear and healthy in a kind of visual hygiene. In fact, the history of modern architecture is completely full of sanatorium. Think about, for example, Joseph Hoffmann's Purkersdorf outside Vienna. This is 903. Think about Otto Wagner, the Steinhof. Think about the Queen Alexandra Sanatorium in Davos in Switzerland of 907, again by architects in collaboration with doctors and with engineers, the cutting edge of architecture, engineering, and medicine. Jan Ducker and Vigée Thonestral Sanatorium in Hilversum, Bablingen, Richard Docker Sanatorium in Bablingen, I mean, multiple ones in Barcelona, José Luis Sert, or this one here, William Gunster and William Pereira, Lake Country Sanatorium in Waukegan, in Illinois. Many other examples, endless actually examples. Many architects did sanatoriums, and somehow these sanatoriums defined them. Sanatorium was, in a way, the testing ground of new materials and techniques of construction, and often invoke experimental collaborations, as I say, between architects, engineers, and doctors. These sanatoriums were typically disconnected from the city, floating like ships in mountains, in forests, by the lakes, or the coast, with row upon row of sand terraces that were treated like little beaches, sometimes linked to artificial beaches, sometimes inside the building, like this artificial beach for kids in a sanatorium in France, or real beaches on the outside. It is, in a way, as if architecture itself was taking the cure. When you look at these buildings adjusting themselves to like a solar device, sometimes stacking themselves in a steep angle, like you can see on the left in this building of Marcel Breuer, a 1930 project for 1,100 bed sanatorium, or even in a steeper angle in this Nicola Bisonti project for the Italian Alps, as you know, with even the elevator at an angle. Even more extreme is this collaboration between a radiologist, Jan Simon, and the architect André Fardet to make a 25-meter-long revolving sanatorium 16 meters above the ground that always face the sun for tuberculosis patients, and then they do another one in Jamagar in India, and there you have all this incredible sophisticated retractable glass walls and specialized focusing instruments to increase the exposure of the sun. Even the bed, as you can see, can be actually suspended in metal frames and adjusted to be rotated to an angle to be aligned with the instruments and with the sun, as you can see here. The sanatorium actually had from the beginning been a laboratory for incubating new attitudes towards form and a spatial organization. If you think about, again, going back to one of the first sanatoriums in the 20th century, the Joseph Hoffmann Purkersdorf, with its purified white surface and radically sharp lines and cubic furniture. It used, for the first time, Hennebike reinforced concrete construction and iron, and the first use of glass and electricity. Electricity was also considered extremely hygienic. Not only was electricity considered more hygienic than gas, of course, but it was used in all kinds of experimental therapies, including electric massage machines, electric bath and chairs for strengthening the nerves. They talk about strengthening the nerves with all this electricity. It's kind of a torture machine. At the time of the purchase of construction, the critic Ludwig Hevesi described it as the naked Hoffman building, whose walls were lined with white porcelain tiles, a white painted wild tile washable wall. Hevesi, the critic, was so enthusiastic as to check himself into the sanatorium to test personally some of these therapeutic devices in the so-called mechanotherapy room. In this elegant white hall, he writes, full of artificial devices, which I made myself closer acquaintance, including the electric massage machines. Everything is electric. Electricity itself was understood to be a medical instrument. The building was actually constructed as an addition to an early sanatorium that was founded by the neuropsychiatrist Richard von Krafft-Ebing, who you see here with his wife. He died before the Purkersdorf was completed, but he was very influential in the ideas of the Purkersdorf. Krafft-Ebing had argued that the modern metropolis was damaging the nerves of its inhabitants, and that air, light, nature, and simplicity were the most effective therapy. He wrote this book over gesunde and kranke nerves, or on healthy and sick nerves. The nerves are very important in this whole story. And a year later, he wrote Psychopathia Sexualis. He also coined the term masochismo after the author Leopold von Sacher Masoch, and popularized the term sadismo. So once again, you can say that health was understood in psychosexual and architectural terms. The Purkersdorf was frequented by a notable circle of patients that include people like, you can see on the top left, Gustav Mahler, Arnold Schoenberg, Hugo von Hofmannsthal, Colomon Moser, who designed the furniture, and many others. Even the architect himself, Josef Hoffmann, checked himself into the Purkersdorf regularly. Apparently, the architect Hoffmann had suffered himself from and was treated for a nervous disorder prior to the commission of the Purkersdorf, and was sympathetic to the Krafft-Ebing's ideas. And according to Edward Seckler, who was the biographer of Hoffmann, it was precisely because of this condition, this nervous condition, we all have nervous conditions at that time, that he was inclined to accept the commission. The Purkersdorf, by the way, despite being a sanatorium, accepted patients with a variety of a wide range of medical conditions, including, listen to this, nervous disorders, neurasthenia, eating disorders, substance abuse, and hysteria. So you may be there because you have tuberculosis, but you may also be there because you have all kinds of other problems. Nobody seemed to have a problem that you will be there for all kinds of things, and maybe you check yourself in with a nervous disorder and come out with tuberculosis, but nobody seemed to think that that was any... Despite, I mean, I don't understand that, but never mind. The sanatorium, what is clear to me is that the sanatorium was seen as a kind of new kind of social space for the Viennese upper class and intelligentsia. They like to be there. Actually, this is Colomon Moser, who designed the furniture and also checked himself into the sanatorium now and then. I'm not so sure what he was suffering from, but here you have him at the time of the of the commission of the sanatorium. He is the one that designed all this cubic furniture. And like Hoffman, he's also a regular in the Purkersdorf. Journalist and art critic Bertha Zuckerndorf, who was a critic actually for the newspaper Wiener Allgemeine Zeitung, characterized the Purkersdorf as a cross between a modern hotel and a modern therapeutic center. And Karl Kraus much more sarcastic, describe it as a healing swindle institution, right? Critics hail the building as one of clarity and truth. In fact, the success of the Purkersdorf owed enormously to the modernity of the architecture. Modern was becoming a new and sophisticated taste among the bourgeoisie and the intelligentsia, who were supposed to dine around a single white table at the Purkersdorf in a kind of talking cure, sleeping what were seen at that time as really Spartan white rooms, and subject themselves to regimes of treatment in white spaces like the ones that you saw before. The association actually of white cubic forms with mental and physical health was already so strong for architecture to act as a kind of effective placebo. The idea is also very much clear in literature. If you read, for example, Thomas Mann, his short novel Tristan, which takes place is 903, the novel, the same year of the construction of the Purkersdorf, is set in an imaginary sanatorium called the Einfried, which Thomas Mann describes as a long, white, rectangular building, warmly recommended for lung patients, but also for patients of all sorts, like Purkersdorf. Sufferers of gastric disorders, people with defective hearts, paralytics, rheumatics, nervous sufferers of all grumblings. And when one of the patients in the novel, her Klotkerhans wife, asks another, "Why are you in the Einfried, really? What cure are you taking?" Herr Espinel, Mr. Espinel, he answers, "Cure? Oh, I'm having myself electrified a bit. Nothing worth mentioning. I will tell you the real reason why I'm here, madame. It is a feeling for a style. Obviously, if people feel one way among furniture that is soft and comfortable and voluptuous, and quite another among the straight lines of these table, chairs, and draperies. This brightness and hardness, this cold, austere simplicity and reserved strength, madame, it has upon me the big ultimate effect of an inward purification and rebirth." Okay, so here you have it clearly said in the words of Thomas Mann. A style is really the cure for whatever ails Mr. Espinel, who, by the way, wears, according to the words of the novel, a white jacket and a white hat in all this white building in a spotless white region, all covered in snow, with white enamel chairs and white folding doors and white painted gallery inhabited by white faces and white hands of patients with their white veil desire by passion driven. Whiteness is actually the most insistent feature of the building, the landscape, and even the patients in this Einfried sanatorium. And with this, I move to another subject, which is the question of sadomasochism. Kraft Evans' idea seems to have been very influential in architects and urban planners. Think, for example, about Camillo Sitte, who criticized the design of the modern city because, in his view, it was causing agoraphobia and other nervous conditions. In his book, in his famous book, City Planning According to Artistic Principles, he advocated the return to kind of intimate urban spaces that, as in medieval times, protect, in his view, the inhabitant. Adolf Loos, another student of masochism, if you want. There are multiple references to masochism in his writings. I don't know how nobody sees that. Argues that the man, he says, that the man with the modern nerves cannot tolerate ornament. In fact, he gave a lecture in 1926 in the Sorbonne, four lectures in German, on the subject precisely of the man with the modern nerve, the man with modern and nerve. The subject of nerve had preoccupied Loos all his life and permeated his writing from the turn of the century. For Loos, the elimination of ornament is not simply an aesthetic choice, as we have thought for so long, but the more I read into it, the more I realize that for him it's a neurological or even a narcotic one. Adolf Loos argues that we moderns no longer have the nerves that are necessary to eat, dress, and decorate as in previous centuries. in Ornament and Crime, a text that I'm sure you have read many times, he speaks precisely of his horror in front of the decorated animals in culinary displays, particularly if he thinks he has to eat one of these stuffed animal corpses, and then he says, I only eat roast beef, right? Roast beef being, of course, the abstraction of meat. He goes on to say that he feels the same nausea precisely in the face of excessive ornament, whether it's in food or in architecture. He says, we like the nerves to drink from an elephant's ivory tusk on which an Amazon battle has been engraved. So we don't have the nerves anymore. It's not that we like it better, simple, without ornament, it's that we feel nausea, we don't have the nerves. But in fact, this obsession, I know, you, of course, when you see these portraits of Kokoschka, of Lodz, you know that this is a very nervous, clearly a very nervous man. Check his hands. So he's totally into the nerves. But this obsession with the nerves, as I say, wasn't just a Viennese hang-up. In his glass architecture of 1914, Paul Serber wrote, and this is an interesting quote too, sanatoria will also want glass buildings. The influence of a splendid glass architecture on the nerves is indisputable. Indisputable. Nothing is indisputable. But of course, he was obsessed himself with hygiene and with removal of dust, pollen, and insects and all these things. He has this amazing telegram novella called The Mid-Ocean High Fever Sanatorium, in which he imagines floating islands with busy, colorful pavilions. This is some of the drawings of Serber. Everyone, he says, in America is plagued by hay fever. So during the flowering season, we will have to live in the middle of the ocean. Our Oceanic Sanatorium Society for High Fever has found just the right thing. Floating islands that will drift hundreds of miles away from dry land and natural islands, on our islands, dirt will be non-existent. Serbert also saw modern technologies as both the cause and the cure of illnesses. He writes that nerve doctors should prescribe the calming effect of color light in sanatorium. Already in 1901, he speculated about air sanatoria flying in the sky to deal with the nervous disorders again caused by the modern city. By air technology, which is at the center of Serber's utopian novels, is both a cure and actually a cause. In a pre-war manifesto for pacifismo written in 1914, he predicted that air warfare, as the epitome, of course, of modern machinery, will generate general insanity. Just thinking, he writes, about all these military techniques can have a deleterious effect on one's nerves. For him, at least, he was prophetic. He suffered a nervous breakdown over the carnage of World War I and starved himself to death in 1915, seemingly in protest. Since he had not taken part really on the war, it was as if just thinking, as he says, had indeed provoked his death. And with this, I move quickly to the architectural cure. Davos in Switzerland, the site, of course, of Thomas Mann's famous novel, The Magic Mountain, was the epitome of the phenomenon of the modern cure. They were already in 1910, there were as 20 and 26 sanatorium already, including this Schwalz, for example, built between 1899 and 1900. And the only sanatorium identified by name in Thomas Mann's famous novel, The Magic Mountain. It was, as I said before, one of these incredible collaborations between a doctor, a cutting-edge doctor, Lucius Spengler, and two young architects from Zurich, Flecker and Hafeli, with the engineer Robert Maillard, who has been working for François Hennebique in France. It was the first building in Switzerland to be constructed in concrete and steel, and it became actually the modern sanatorium. So you can see that the cutting edge in medical treatment coincides also with the most advanced technology in architecture. The architecture of the Schwalz is totally brutal for us, it's not, but it was really totally brutal in its horizontality and abstraction, with this 100 meters long facade and endless corridors that are built like an ocean liner, with these terraces that are dimensioned for a patient reclining in these specially designed chairs, for the cure to be undertaken between 7 a.m. and 10 p.m. in winter and in summer. So you have these period photographs with doing kind of a nice day with all these people attending, but you also have this period of photograph of a group of patients lying in the chairs, totally covering a thick blanket of snow, and they, you know, before all these attendants, and here they seem to be being left alone with the broom as caretaker. And the funny thing is that they seem totally happy, like this one. You see that they are really mad. I mean, maybe this one in the middle is trying to see whether he can get something going, but it's not going to happen, right? But look at this. Like all of a sudden, they're all like, okay. Thomas Mann, always sensitive to architectural detail. If you read again The Magic Mountain, you will see it's completely full of the details of what a modern building is, there's a lot of architecture there. Describes the therapeutic chaise longue with a lot of care, evoking a philosophy of life on the edge and in the horizontal. This therapy of the horizontal was also central to the Bald Sanatorium, also in Davos, where Katia Mann, Thomas' wife, has stayed and inspired him to write The Magic Mountain. Mann's novel evokes the social life in this very modern building, where everything was wrapped in white, even the patient here, all wrapped in white to receive hydrotherapy. Katia Mann was actually, in fact, one of the first patients in this brand new sanatorium. She had fallen ill in 1912, a year after the birth of her fourth child. Her mother was convinced that Katia was not suffering from tuberculosis, but from exhaustion. Having had four children and two miscarriages in less than 5 years, managing a large household, and even typing Thomas Mann manuscripts. Katia, by the way, had been studying mathematics and experimental physics with Wilhelm Röntgen, not less, the inventor of the X-rays, but her mother had encouraged her to abandon her studies to marry Thomas Mann at the age of 21. Whatever her ailment, she stayed in and out of sanatorium up to 1914, when she went back home and had two more kids. Bam. Tuberculosis, in any case, was often confounded with nervous disorders of all kind, and its inevitable melancholy meant that the standard cure was also a psychological one. Sanatoriums offer somehow not just an escape from the city, but an escape from normal domestic life, with the comfort of a controlled regime and a steady yet distracting daily rhythm in the company of new friends. These hyper-design spaces of the clinic even represented a new form of domestic elegance. In fact, Katia Mann says the experience had strengthened her so that she could stand it all. And of course, there was a lot to stand. World War II, the exile to the United States, the suicide of her favorite son, Klaus, and then the suicide of her second son, Michael. Does one stand all of that? I don't know. In any case, the modern ocean liner for the rich and fabulous becomes democratized eventually with sanatoriums such as the Zonnestrand in Hilversum, 20 miles outside Amsterdam. Zonnestrand actually means sunbeam in Dutch. It was designed by Jan Ducker and Bijouet as a sanatorium for the General Diamonds Workers' Union of the Netherlands. In this, again, reinforced concrete white building, the medical properties of the architecture are again taken to the stream, almost as a kind of manifesto. Zonnestrand was a kind of health machine, a factory for the manufacturing of healthy bodies. This is the slogan, lacked, licked, looked, allow air, sun, and light, air, and sun. So in many ways, like the manifesto of modern architecture. And here, the patients are also wheeled directly from their rooms into the terrace, which no longer is a kind of social space, but more like there is less interaction with the patients, at least in this period. Photographs, keeping their heads inside the room and into their books. The real interaction here is with the sun and with the machines, these complex respiratory analysis devices. The idea of individual rooms seems to have been an advance in working class sanatoriums, I thought. But then reading again Thomas Bernhard, whose novels also are very, very important to me to understand tuberculosis, because he spent many years in and out of tuberculosis sanatoriums and as a tuberculosis patient himself, and it infiltrates all his writings, then I became aware that there was nothing more terrifying to a sanatorium patient than being moved to an individual room. That could only mean one thing. Death itself was hidden. Sanatoriums in Davos and in other places did not accept very ill patients. They would not accept you. A death was, of course, a spot in their reputation, and they even exaggerated the rate of cure. Subterranean tunnels carried the dead away and out of view, and at the south, which is 300 meters above the town of Davos, the bodies of the dead were sent down the mountain on toboggans in winter, as Thomas Mann writes in The Magic Mountain. Already in Tristan, in the novel that I mentioned before, Thomas Mann has written, sometimes a death takes place among the most severe cases. When this happens, no one knows it, not even the person sleeping next door. In the silence of the night, the waxen guest is put away, and life at Einfried goes tranquilly on with his massage, his electric treatment, the douches, the baths, his exercise, his steaming and inhaling in rooms especially equipped with all the triumphs of modern therapeutic. Right? So there you have it. Death in modernity is always hidden. Visual hygiene also means designing that you don't see or what you don't want to see. Otto Wagner, for example, planned for the Großstadt, for the big city of 1911, included high-speed trains, and you may want to know in a little second what was the rush, that were to remove the dead, transporting corpses in their coffins from specially designed mortuary stations to the cemeteries in the outskirts of the city, far away and very fast. Every large city, he says, will soon be in a position to limit the transportation of corpses to railroads, and therefore in each neighborhood there should be a mortuary station where you send the bodies away. And of course, you can also think about Brasilia with the hospitals at the very far end of the two arms of the city. We don't want to see death. But to finish, perhaps we can talk about how more significant I think that the architecture of the sanatorium as medical instrument is the impact of medical thought on all of modern architecture, the constant preoccupation with ventilation, with sunlight, with hygiene, with white walls. As Ulrich, the figure of Robert Musil, the man without qualities, put it in his novel, which is about 1913 Vienna, modern man is born in a hospital and dies in a hospital. Therefore, he should also live in a place like a hospital. Right? This Musil was probably referring to Otto Wagner, who also had formulated the idea that modern man should live in a place like a hospital. And he claimed that the hotel room should not be very different than a hospital room, with white surfaces that should replace the upholstered interiors of the 19th century, where dust accumulates and illness is latent. So at the very beginning of the century, you have all these architects always obsessed with the idea of the health. Very quickly, in fact, I'm going to cut through here, but just to go to the fact that, in fact, every building in the end becomes a kind of sanatorium. Take, for example, the open-air school in Amsterdam, built a couple of years after Zonnestraal by the same architects, Ducker and Bijoué, and who applied the principles of light, air, sun, but now to healthy children. They were placed inside this glass machine and even required to sit up in the roof, taking the air and the sun. So the building is conceived as a light device, very much like those used for light therapy in the 1930s in places that they didn't have enough sun, like in this image that we use in the publicity, right, of kids in a school going through all these machines to provide sun therapy. Nobody seemed to be thinking anything about skin cancer, right? That will become the problem of the next generation. That was always like, is this right, or should I check this one out or not, right? So every age has its own health obsessions and preoccupations. Okay, so how could I finish? Maybe I finish with a story that maybe you like very quickly about the Tugendhat House, because not only did modern architects emphasize health and exercise in opposition to the dangers of the disease, sometimes presenting themselves as models, but their architecture was also understood that way. The buildings become unconsciously identified with the healthy body. For example, you have here Miss van der Rohe Tugendhat House, which is not just in Brno, in Czechoslovakia, which is not just a modern house, but the ur-modern house in the cover of the great exhibition Modern Architecture of the Museum of Modern Art in 1931 that became popular with the book The International Style. In the catalogue, they have the image of the Tugendhat in the front, and in the first edition of the International Style is still the Tugendhat in the back. Well, the story that interests me is that the building, of course, was abandoned during the German occupation of Czechoslovakia, and when it was taken over by the communist bureaucrats, they say, what do we do with this weird building? Okay, what do? We turn it into a hospital for children with a rehabilitation center for children with disabilities. In fact, here you have this living room of the Tugendhat house with these kids with orthopedic problems exercising. In fact, before this, it was turned into a kind of physical education institute, where you have all these kids and young people using the house. This is the terrace, actually, of the Tugendhat. And what these bureaucrats of communist bureaucrats in Czechoslovakia didn't seem to realize is that actually the house had been photographed in its early years in exactly the same spirit. You see early 1930s photographs of the naked Tugendhat kids playing in the sun in the terrace, which of course are uncannily echo in the 1950s images of children exercises in the living room or the terrace of the house. The Tugendhat themselves, the clients, may have understood the house as a machine for health too. In response to an architectural critic that had polemically asked in the pages of an architectural magazine, is the Tugendhat house habitable? Fritz Tugendhat symptomatically invoked Davos. Nobody has asked him about the sanatorium, but he says the following. After almost a year of living in the house, I can assure you without hesitation that technically it possesses everything a modern person might wish for. On clear and frosty days, one can lower its windows, sit in the sun, and enjoy the view of a snow-covered landscape like in Davos. Like in Davos? In Davos, in a sanatorium. So in winter, the family, he describes, will sit by the big glass in the living rooms. We could lower into the ground. As you know, the whole panel of glass can come to the ground until it disappears completely, taking the sun and the fresh air with the snow outside, like in Davos, like in a sanatorium. These photographs of the kids playing and running around naked in the garden evoke the ideas of the Levens reform movement, too. But Fritz Tugendhat, apparently, and this is also an interesting discovery that I did during this research, himself was not in good health at the time of the commission of the house, and may have commissioned this house with this in mind. Mies himself recalls he was a very careful man, and he was sick. He did not believe in one doctor only. He had three. And this is kind of interesting because Mies didn't seem to realize that this was actually not that unusual. Uncertainty in the early 20th century about the new scientific medicine made it commonplace among the bourgeoisie and people who could afford to consult different kinds of doctors and alternative practitioners and to follow multiple advice. In a way, I have the sense that the architect was added as a new kind of, another kind of, or yet another medical consultant. And with this, I leave you here. Thank you very much.
much, Beatrice, for an absolutely fantastic lecture. And thank you all for attending this very special Dean's Lecture this evening. We're now holding a reception out in the foyer that you just passed in to come into this theatre to celebrate Beatrice's visit to the faculty. And you're all welcome to join us for some refreshments and to continue the conversation more informally. Thank you very much. Thank you.